Mammoth
Audio. This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. Everybody wants to be somebody. I've always wanted to be Neil Patrick Harris. Fantastic actor, talented magician, incredibly good looking. That guy must do really well with the ladies. The Ditchbourne claimant was also a man looking for a new identity. But who was he? A British nobleman lost at sea? A 19th century Australian butcher looking to cash in? Or was he the mysterious Arthur Orton? On this episode of the podcast, historian and author of The Man Who Lost Himself, Robin Anear, helps me examine this weird chapter in Australian history. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. I'm very, very excited to be talking to you because I read your book when it first came out and absolutely loved it. It feels like I was reading a mystery story. Is it a mystery story?
I think it is. Yeah, I hope so. And a lot of people say they got to the end and didn't know what I thought.
That's good.
I don't know if I knew what I thought, so that worked well.
Yes. Yeah, it reminded me of the quote by Mark Twain, with the history of Australia is filled with the most beautiful lies.
Beautiful lies. People came here to reinvent them. Well, they came here to reinvent themselves, or they just did when they got here. But, the beginnings of Australia are full of reinvented people.
I guess it's very hard to travel from one side of the world to the other and not have it change you into someone else.
Yeah, I think so. And some people just ran with that. You know, they just blossomed when they stepped off at the wharf and thought, I can be whoever I want to be. And you know, they were.
Well, we should go right back to the beginning.
We should.
And we should. I guess Roger Tichborne is the best place to begin, the man himself.
Yep, I think so.
So who was Roger Tichborne at the time of his disappearance?
At the time of his disappearance, Roger Tichborne was the son and heir of a baronet, so a lowly ranked nobleman in England, with quite vast estates and fortune, the father, that is. And his mother was a French woman, so he'd been treated as a bit of a delicate flower by this oversensitive mother and a father who disapproved of his oversensitive son. He was not the man he could have been or his father wanted him to be, and he was trying to rebel somewhat and he was trying to become a man, I think. And so he boarded a ship and headed for South America and adventure and reinvention.
My image of him is of a sort of weak, you know, no chin and a little sort of sad pencil moustache and a sort of a fop almost.
He was foppish, and his moustache, you're right, it was very thin and wispy. I don't know that it was pencil. I think it was one of those moustaches that had never been shaven, and it was as good as you could do in the absence of sticky tape to, you know, pull out and make the hairs grow more. But yeah, he was pretty weak and foppish, and had been bullied at boarding school. He'd been in the army and been pretty much bullied there too, I think. So he'd been the butt of many jokes. He'd been raised speaking both French and English. In fact, I think more French than English, probably spoke English with a French accent, which was strange for an English nobleman, and was teased about that, among other things, including the fact that apparently he had a retractable penis. So,
Well, now hang on. Was this in the book? Because I feel like I would have.
It was brought up by a number of witnesses.
And by itself.
Army witnesses, right. Witnesses who'd known him in the army, in his army days and at school, and in the army he had been known as Smallcock. This was believed to be why, that there's some kind of, they said he had a penis like a horse's, but it's not what you thought. It wasn't that it was big, it was that it retracted when not in use.
In like a car aerial.
Yeah, that's it.
I feel like we should just talk for the rest of the interview about Roger Tichborne's retractable penis.
I know, it's like a car accessory.
Yeah, that's amazing. So where did he, I mean, what did he do then? What was his choice of like, he's obviously, he's upset his father, he's kind of not failed in the military, but hasn't done well in anything in life. Where did he go? What did he do?
Well, he jumped on board a ship, sailed as the only passenger in a ship bound for South America, had a few adventures there, rode fast horses across plains in Chile and so forth, and ended up in a shipwreck and apparently was never heard of again.
And so now we flash forward some years.
We flash forward. So that was 1854, and his mother sought him by shanghaiing sailors at Portsmouth, not that far from where the family property was, and other ports, and asking them had they heard anything of the fate of the ship that Roger was on. Some of them would tell her they had in return for some money or a square meal. And she also advertised extensively in newspapers across the world that her husband had died by this time. So really the fortune and the title was up for grabs. She did have a younger son, but she felt that he was not the proper heir because she continued to believe that her beloved Roger was still alive. So she advertised saying, anybody who knew the whereabouts of Roger Tichborne should contact her, Lady Tichborne, and would hear something to their advantage.
And so it was clear then that people were going to take advantage of her. The sailors obviously provided her with information regardless if they had it or not. Mm-hmm. And she was ripe for the pickings.
Yeah, she'd certainly been strung along by stories that she'd been told that, maybe I had heard that a ship had picked bound for Australia, had picked up a few castaways from that ship, and, you know, that was why she directed her interest to Australia. So she'd been told numerous stories over the intervening, 13 years, and had directed her inquiries accordingly. Now is the time for Australia, and you're right, she was absolutely right for the picking.
She reminds me a little bit of the people who, obviously, when they've lost a loved one, who head to the psychics and clairvoyants and mediums, or even people who have lost a pet and they get a phone call from someone saying, I found you. This is incredible. I'm a truck driver and I opened the back of my, you know, I just drove from Melbourne to Darwin, for example, and I just opened the truck and I've got your dog here. I'll send you back via freight. It'll just cost you $500. And it's that taking advantage of people who are at their wit's end.
I think she was at her wit's end even before Roger went, though. She was a fairly flighty, neurotic, difficult woman, I think, which is part of what Roger was running away from. She was always a difficult character, and this was just a continuation of that difficultness.
So even a shipwreck and a disappearance wasn't enough to cut the apron strings.
No, exactly. He wasn't getting away that easy.
And so we need to head even further away from England to Australia and to not to Sydney or Melbourne, but to the outback almost.
The great interior, yeah. Lady Tichborne's advertisement sparked a response from a butcher in Wagga Wagga, 1867, saying, I am your son, long lost. I'm living in, you know, distressed and reduced circumstances, and I hope that you won't be ashamed of what I have become. But he sent her a photograph of himself dressed in his working gear with long, greasy hair, significant number of kilos heavier than he'd last been. And that was the beginning of the claim that was made on the Tichborne fortune.
Now, he didn't write that letter immediately, though, did he? He didn't sort of come out of nowhere with the letter. Wasn't there a local lawyer or a local figure who kind of nudged him in the right direction to get it started?
Yeah, it's really hard to know by whom he was nudged and whether how much he was asking to be nudged. He insinuated, he planted the idea on people, the suggestion on people that he may have been something more than he appeared to be, and waited for people to respond and say, could you be this Roger Tichborne who's advertised for in the paper? You know, he kind of led people to extract the information rather than putting himself forward. It was an interesting two steps forwards, one back kind of dance that he did.
Well, I think
with his identity.
Yeah, rather than making a claim, you invite others to ask if you're making a claim.
Yes.
And you can imply that you are, and that means that they're creating the idea in their head. If someone reaches an opinion of their own free will, it's a much harder to get that idea out of their head.
That's right. And especially if you're planting that idea with someone like a lawyer, it gives legitimacy from the start if it's coming from them rather than from yourself, if it has to be drawn out of you as it was out of him. But he also had at least one friend in his immediate circle in Wagga Wagga who seems to have coached him somewhat or encouraged him somewhat. Possibly have coached him in the business of putting himself forward.
He wasn't it wasn't just that he was a butcher as well. He was living in a shack. He didn't have much in the way of resources or assets, and it wasn't wasn't what we would imagine today as a butcher. It was a really rough life that he had.
It was a really rough life, and he'd made what certainly for Roger Tichborne would have been an unfavourable, an unsavoury marriage. Very recently, he'd knocked up a young servant girl or young servant woman and married her, and she was a pretty rough character from all accounts. So he wasn't just putting himself forward as Roger Tichborne. He, you know, in reality, he was putting her forward as Lady Tichborne, which, you know, was an even greater step forward. But yes, he was living in very low circumstances. And as he alluded when he finally did, write this letter to Lady Tichborne, his mother, he had done things that he was ashamed of during his years in Australia. So there was the suggestion of a dark backstory. You know, obviously he hadn't landed in Wagga. It was nowhere near the coast. So getting there from wherever it was that he had come was a long and slightly sordid story. Yeah.
Sounds like you're casting dispersions on the good people of Wagga.
Possibly.
Lovely. I actually went to Wagga for a wedding a few years ago, and I took your book with me and went on a walking tour of the Tichborne claimant, which I have to admit was disappointing, because I looked at the photos and the map and sort of went, well, okay, there's an art centre where the shack would have been, and this is where the butcher would, and this is the hotel, which I've forgotten the name of, the Austral, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I looked at, okay, well, that's a completely different building, but that's where it would have stood.
Exactly.
I went into the little cafe there and told them, did you know? And they did not care. And I went to the wedding and drove home. Oh, but no, I went to the museum. Have you been to the Tichborne Museum in Wagga that is there now?
No.
They have a museum in which they have sort of local artists and so on, and they have a section dedicated to the Tichborne claimant. And they have, aside from just sort of photographs of the area and of him, they have some of the memorabilia from the court case.
Oh, because I knew they had some great stuff in their library collection.
Well, they've brought it out, and it's on display, so you can see the figurines of all the characters and the ashtrays.
Yep.
I've looked on eBay, but every time I search, all I get is people offering to sell me copies of your book.
How could those things not turn up, those Tichborne case souvenirs? Because there were so many thousands of them.
Yeah.
Perhaps they're just not, perhaps people don't know what they are. They've got to still exist. Yeah.
So, I mean, Lady Tichborne must have had other people or offer information in the years since Roger's disappearance. What made her decide, no, this is the man, this is the one that I'm going to put my money behind?
Well, it's interesting. I don't recall finding in my research that she had dealt with much in the way of prior claimants. There may have been one or two who'd kind of flirted around the idea, but she didn't seem to have been, you know, seriously approached by anybody, which would have made this, if that were the case, this would have really made this stand out as a serious contender, you know, as the Roger. I think, you know, her information to that date had pretty much been confined to secondhand reports of the possibility of Roger's whereabouts rather than any direct claims. So.
It's almost biblical, and I might be drawing a long bow here, but that's what the edit is for. but that idea of, you know, like around the time of Jesus, that there were all of the various people claiming that they had a direct line to God, or they could speak for God, or they knew what God wanted, and Jesus came out and said, "No, I am God." And Roger Tichborne sort of did the same thing. He didn't go by any half measures. He wasn't saying, I might have some information, I might know something. He laid it all on the line and said, it's me.
Yeah. It was a huge risk to take, whether or not he was Roger. For someone so changed as he appeared to be since his disappearance. And also, if he was Roger, who didn't really want to go home to his mother. I mean, had been trying to avoid her, one would imagine, all those years. In whatever case, it was a big risk to take. Yeah.
So what were the differences, the physical differences between Roger and this man?
Well, Roger was a very thin, weedy, hollow-chested youth. This guy was barrel chested, selling him short. He was a big man, not so much taller than Roger, I don't think, who was kind of average height for those times, 5'6", 5'7", but a really meaty man, not to make a pun on the fact that he was a butcher, but he was a really meaty fella. The other physical differences were that he had very droopy earlobes, very pendulous earlobes, whereas Roger, now there were no photos of Roger, illustrations of Roger. He was one of those people who had little or no earlobe. Now, explanations were given for this, were sought and given, for instance, that his days and possibly weeks at sea following the shipwreck in a lifeboat, during which time he was sunburned and delirious, had caused his earlobes to grow. A doctor was wheeled out at some stage over the years of the claim being made, who supported this and said, yes, in fact, this was shown. It could happen that in cases of extreme sunburn and dehydration that the earlobes could grow in such a way. So that was a difference. We don't know about his penis. Roger Tichborne had the retractable penis, and there is a suggestion, because the claimant did have to drop his Dax at some stage in the course of his claim and be examined by a doctor. And the suggestion was, well, maybe not suggestion, I think the statement was made straight out in the trial that he also had a penis like a horse's, which retracted when not in use. So,
although being a larger man, it would have been a lot harder to tell.
He had a very big belly by the time that doctor examined him, so I think the doctor had to go looking with a pair of tweezers to find it. So, I don't know, you're exactly right. So there was the penis, there were the ears, which were different. There was the shape of the man. He spoke with no trace of a French accent and, in fact, could not speak any French.
I can believe people can gain weight, they can lose weight, they can lose accents, their earlobes can sag or grow or change. But the idea that you can learn and forget an entire language, and one that you said was...
His first language.
His first language is, to me, just beggars belief.
I agree. But again, he said... You know, the shock of being lost at sea and of spending the intervening years in such low company and low circumstances. He'd forgotten so much of his former self, and lost touch with it. So he could not speak French. He didn't speak with a French accent. In fact, he spoke with a Cockney accent. Again, he attributed that to the company he'd been keeping. He told the story of having been working as a bushworker, really, on farms and properties and butcher shops, on properties, right through Gippsland, the north of Victoria, and into the Riverina of New South Wales over these years, that he'd, you know, been droving and stealing horses even, he suggested, and this, you know, he was cagey about this and was saying this was part of the reason he hadn't come forward before now, because he risked exposing himself to in all sorts of ways, because he was a sought man for crimes that he kind of hedged around. You know, there was some suggestion over the years that he was being hunted for murder and so on, and he didn't exactly do a lot to dispel those rumours. He was willing to entertain almost any rumour with regard to himself. He liked being a man of mystery.
Yeah, it's interesting, because most imposters historically do the opposite, and they make claims about themselves. In order to solidify their claims, they try and put forward themselves as being respectable, and because they're respectable, they're therefore more trustworthy. Mm-hmm. So you have people like Frank DeMara pretended he was a surgeon, or Frank Abagnale Jr. Pretended he was an airline pilot.
Yeah, yeah.
And that would give you, you know, by pretending to be someone trustworthy, people are more likely to believe you. Whereas he seems to have done the opposite and said, the reason why you should believe me is because I've got stuff to hide.
Yes.
And that's why I haven't come forward until now. It's almost like someone trying to sell you a stereo that's fallen off the back of a truck.
Yeah.
You're more likely to buy it because you don't want to, without asking any questions.
Exactly. No questions asked. So I think there was something of that in his approach. And it was also, I think, the only way he knew. I think he was a man without guile. I really do. And he was trying out stories all the time. And I have a strong feeling that he'd done that all his life, whether he were Roger or not. I have a feeling that trying out stories, trying out identities, trying out, you know, toying with ideas about himself as a bad guy or a good guy, and seeing what people would buy. was something he was used to doing.
And it was something that he could get away with, being the late 19th century. That
yeah.
He could tell a story on the main street of Wagga and there's no chance that it's going to get back to London.
That's right. But he'd also change his story as the claimant. And his claim went on over many years. It extended over many years and two large court trials back in London. He would change his story frequently and seemed to have no concerns about that. He didn't seem to think that it made him less credible. He seemed to think that his willingness to admit that he'd lied or that he was wrong or that he'd forgotten or people would forgive that. And so often he was right. They did. They did. People would buy it nonetheless. So not having any footage of the man, not being able to really read his body language and his demeanour so well from the photographs, even though there are quite a lot of them, you can only think that there must have been something very winning about him, which is belied by the descriptions of him, by his appearance, because he became fatter and fatter and a less attractive looking character. There must have been something about him, though, that was winning to a lot of people, I think.
And how did he go from being someone who sort of made these claims from Wagga to being a man who is standing in London?
He basically found investors. Mm. So he found people who would back him, who would back his claim.
Oh.
The idea being if his claim was successful, if he came into the Tichborne fortune, he stood to, yeah, it was a real fortune.
Yeah.
And these people would, they were lawyers, they were businessmen. I mean, starting off with his lawyer in Wagga and businessmen in Sydney, quite big businessmen, put their money behind him, paid his fares, dressed him up, got him a haircut, put him up at a good hotel in Sydney while he was waiting for the ship.
Mm.
And basically also bought him more backers. So their back, you know, their respectability and their investment in him would buy him more respectability and more investment. So he found himself investors essentially.
It reminds me of the Drake descendants scam that was popular at the turn of the century, which mm-hmm. was basically the implication was that in England there was an impending lawsuit in which the descendants of Francis Drake were suing the government for money that he had and treasure that he had discovered on his journeys that was supposedly his but had been confiscated by the government. And this was a surefire slam dunk lawsuit.
Mm.
And all you needed to do was to invest, to pay the lawyer's fees. And so people were basically buying shares in the Drake fortune.
Huh.
And try, you know, and of course it didn't exist. There was no such lawsuit. There was no such, and they would change the stories and they would change the detail of who was actually going to be getting the money and who was this descendant who they'd discovered. But people latched onto it as a particularly, you know, during the Depression as a way of, of making some money. And it sort of pointed out that for a lot of people, you didn't have to believe 100%. You just needed to believe more than 50% for it to be a good, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
If you could be right on the stock exchange 51% of the time, you'd be a billionaire.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess for these men, these investors, they didn't need to believe 100% or be 100% certain in the same way as Lady Tichborne did. They just needed to believe enough to, you know, to put some money behind it.
Yeah. It was a gamble. And when they clapped eyes on this guy, they must have realized it was a gamble. But yeah, like you say, they must have done their sums and thought, it's worth it. Why not?
But of course, once they've committed, they have to put forward the idea that they are 100% certain. And that was what sort of sparked the belief in respectable society.
That is exactly right. And that was one of the things I found so interesting is how unwilling people were to change their minds, at least publicly, once they declared their support for the Tichborne claimant. It was a very difficult thing to lose face and to change your mind, even in the face of the most ludicrous improbabilities that did develop, along the way. And one figure, his lawyer in London, Mr. Holmes, his solicitor, who backed him to the hilt for several years, stood out to me as an outstanding figure in the whole story, in that he finally did the Emperor's New Clothes thing and said, I do not believe. I've changed my mind. And he was an exceptional character for that, because he was almost the only person who publicly changed his mind and withdrew his support. People just didn't. And I also think that the buying of support from different markets, if you like, market segments, was part of the reason why the claimant sold himself in different ways, told different stories, changed his story a bit depending on who the audience was, mm-hmm. who he was telling his story to. He really sold himself to, yeah, to whoever. So if his audience was a huge coliseum, a huge theatre full of working people in the north of England, and these are some of the, he did address crowds like this in the course of getting support and getting money to conduct the court trials, that he had to fund. He would tell them the story that he thought they wanted to hear about how he was not accepted by friends and relatives of the Tichbornes in England, with the exception of Lady Tichborne, because he presented as a common working man like them, and it was all a conspiracy of the nobility against the working classes and so on. So he would shift his story and certainly recalibrate his identity depending on who he was addressing.
So it was essentially a Tichborne bubble.
It was like a
real estate bubble, yep. or the South Sea bubble. It was people investing on the back of investing on this one principal idea that didn't really matter if it was true or not, because you were just doubling your bet and
exactly that's
getting
right
further and further in.
Yeah. Yep.
And
yep.
So what happened when he finally came face to face with Lady Tichborne?
So he arrived in England. He met first with her legal representatives, I think, who went, no way. But nonetheless, he went to Paris, where Lady Tichborne was. He was absolutely terrified of meeting her. He made himself ill. She had to meet him in a darkened room, which you might think he had orchestrated, but he seemed to be seriously unwell with nerves. And she came into the room and took one look at him, and presumably didn't just look at him, but smelt him and felt him, and was convinced in an instant that he was her beloved Roger, and she never expressed a moment's doubt thereafter. She was rather somewhat horrified by what he had become. Certainly she was horrified by the wife that he brought home with him. but she never wavered in her support of him. And she was a neurotic and bloody-minded woman, and there is, to me, a strong sense that she would have supported whomever came forward because she wanted to thwart the rest of the Tichborne family.
Yeah. And also, I guess, prove all of the people who had told her he was dead wrong.
That's right.
So she was much like the rest of the people who had invested.
Exactly. It was her investment.
It was hers. It was an emotional one, but still it was there. So if she was the lady, Dowager lady, and she was the person whose opinion mattered, why was there a court case? Why didn't she just say welcome and everyone else just has to put up with this man, regardless if they believed in him or not?
The reason it mattered that he was the real Roger was that he was making a claim for the Tichborne fortunes and title, and those were in the possession of Roger Tichborne's younger brother, Henry.
Mm-hmm.
He had inherited them because Roger had been dead for 12 or 13 years. So he had to wrest them from Henry, and the rest of the family and most of the rest of decent society supported Henry, and not just supported Henry, but supported the idea of inheritance and the laws thereof, and standing up against potential imposters and so on. You know, good society in England had a lot at stake here, not just Henry Tichborne. So, that was the opposition that she met. So, he had to make the claimant, the Tichborne claimant, Roger. Sir Roger, so-called, had to make a claim through Chancery saying, I am the real Roger Tichborne, and a civil court case was launched, him against, I guess, not Henry Tichborne, but apparently his agent, I think, was the name that was used.
Like the estate.
The estate. So him against the Tichborne estate, and what had to be proven in this civil trial was that he was really Roger Tichborne.
And is that where it really captured the public's imagination? Is that the moment where the public starts making the papers, when it's rich versus poor, high society versus low society, the you know, Great Britain versus the colonies.
Yes, like, exactly. The trial represented all those things, all those oppositions, and it did make the papers in a big way. And of course, making the papers was everything in those times. So it made the papers in a huge way, and the trial was covered extensively, for days and weeks on end. That trial went on for months. But ahead of the trial, both sides, initially the Tichborne family's, the estate's side, and then in response to that, the claimant's side, mounted these amazing commissions of inquiry to all the places where Roger and the claimant had been supposed to be, over the 12, 13 years of Roger's disappearance. And they travelled to South America and followed in the footsteps of Roger, and they came to Australia and followed the trail that the claimant said that he had taken, and collected evidence from witnesses all along the way. They hired detectives to follow up stories and assemble witnesses and so on. So rather than bringing all the witnesses to London, they went out afoot and a boat and collected this evidence themselves. Now, the claimant had said he would go and present himself at these inquiries so that people could look at him and say, that is the man, that is Roger Tichborne, I remember him. But he got sick on the way and never actually made it as far as as Chile, which was where the commissions of inquiry began. So he never had to front any of those colonial and South American witnesses. But that process of collecting evidence from dozens, not hundreds at that stage, but dozens and dozens of colonial and foreign witnesses was extraordinary. And all that evidence is printed up and can be seen, I think, in the Mitchell Library in Sydney. And it's just extraordinary, you know, both sides of the case putting the various stories and playing off the claimant's stories against what these people remembered.
It sounds like at this point the claim and the story, whether it's true or not, is well and truly out of the claimant's hands.
Well, that's it. Yeah.
He has lost control of the story, and mm-hmm. and he can stand in front of an audience and he can tell different variations, but you've got the papers and the public and detectives and it's a worldwide operation, and there are now so many people involved that he couldn't possibly stop it from going, you know, sort of playing out.
That's right. And every one of these witnesses that was encountered had almost as many variations on the story, on their colonial story to tell as what he had had. And so the story just grew tentacles and grew in many directions, and other potential identities for this claimant were brought up as a result.
So what are some of the other claims, right?
He was living in Wagga and working in Wagga as Thomas Castro.
Mm-hmm. But this is when Arthur Orton comes onto the scene.
That's right, yeah. So the name Arthur Orton had not been heard until the time of these commissions of inquiry. And it was when they went to South America even, but certainly when they came to Australia, and they had photographs of the claimant, obviously, and started showing these around to the various witnesses. So they went to Gippsland. They had a commission in Sale and in Melbourne. These are places he'd been through, in Sale and in Melbourne. And they went to Sydney and Wagga. And so, Deniliquin. They also went to Deniliquin and Hay and a few other places up around the Riverina taking evidence. These are all places the claimant was supposed to have been.
These are very small. I mean, they're small today.
That's right. Not so small then.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. And what emerged was this whole, mosaic of itinerant workers who actually moved along this trail. Mm-hmm. What emerged, well, to me, particularly during the research, is there was this thing that has since been called the Vandemonian Trail, where people would leave Tasmania, sometimes as escaped convicts, sometimes as convicts who'd done their time, come up through Gippsland. They'd come across to Port Albert, a small port there in Gippsland, not far from Sale, up through Sale and through the very meagerly populated parts of the Alps, Dargo and such places, across the Alps to Ned Kelly country, around Beechworth and so on, and then from there up through to the Riverina. And this was a well-worn trail, not just by itinerant bushworkers and farm workers, but also by cattle stealers and particularly horse thieves. They would trade, they would steal horses on one side of the Alps, change their brands and move them on and sell them either over the Alps or up in the Riverina. And this is a well-worn trail. And this is the trail that emerged that had been followed by Tom Castro. And it seemed as if you got to us, they backtracked on his story and you got to a certain point, sort of on one side of the Alps, he became Tom Castro. On the other side, the southern side of the Victorian Alps in Gippsland, no one had ever heard of Tom Castro. But people looked at the photo and said, that looks a lot like a guy I knew called Arthur Orton. And this is where Arthur Orton came into the story. And they seemed to merge, these two people. Not many people looked at the photo and said, people who'd known Roger Tichborne and felt that that was the man. And so the character of Arthur Orton was tracked back to Hobart, where he had been a young butcher there. He'd come out on a ship in 1855 or so from London. He'd been raised in Wapping by the docks there, had learned the trade of butchering and had, come out to Hobart and had worked his way up the Vandemonian Trail. And at some point, Arthur Orton had disappeared, but Tom Castro had not taken his place necessarily, but he'd come into prominence. And that was the man who emerged at Wagga. Now, the story, the mystery was, were they the same man? Had Arthur Orton been murdered by someone? Was Tom Castro really Roger Tichborne? Had he been involved in murdering Arthur Orton? Or perhaps the other had occurred and perhaps they had known one. And so some people told a story of knowing a man who could have been Roger Tichborne in the company of Arthur Orton, you know. And so it went. These improbable combinations of characters, and they seemed to merge at some point in Wagga or on the way there in the person of Tom Castro.
It almost seems like in the same way as Tom Castro sort of appeared as being Roger Tichborne, that you have Arthur Orton appearing to be Tom Castro. Mm. So you now have these two potential sort of directions it can go.
He can
become a lord, or he can become a lowly butcher.
A butcher from Wapping,
A butcher from Wapping. And that, I guess, in the public's mind would further solidify their opinions, because those who believe that he is a fraud now have a clear idea of who he is.
Yes.
But also those who believe he's not a fraud now have this idea of what he's sort of fighting against.
Yes. Yeah.
And that must have not helped in terms of finding the truth at all, because people were starting, would have just become more rabid in their opinions.
That's right. Exactly. It became more polarized and more polarizing. In some ways, telling the story the way I'm telling it and the way we're talking about it sounds absolutely bleeding obvious it must have been Arthur Orton. You've got this big guy who matches the stories of what Arthur Orton was like, who had this kind of Cockney accent and is a butcher, and it seems kind of obvious. But when you get this plethora of voices overlaying one another and telling these competing stories, that the amount of doubt that comes into the whole thing, especially when you get, these people from Gippsland talking about these murders that they heard of that happened in the outback, and they were sure that this Arthur Orton guy was there and then he wasn't, and it plays with your mind, and it played with the minds of everybody involved in the case.
It's that sort of, but what if?
Yeah, exactly.
No one wants to be the person to deny this man or to sentence him.
It just wasn't the sort of certainty you might think that there'd be, given that this guy just didn't seem like a good candidate to be Roger Tichborne as he had been. They tracked down members of the Orton family still living in Wapping. He had, a big family of brothers and sisters, and they were among the witnesses. Some of them were among the witnesses who gave evidence at the civil trial, saying that he definitely wasn't their brother, Arthur. But anyway, this trial, came to court, and it went on for quite a number of months, and the judge said, I've heard enough. I've heard enough. We don't have to hear any more evidence. I mean, he felt that it was clear cut. And he said, I don't believe that you are Roger Tichborne. The trial is over. I'm not granting your claim. Now, as soon as that happened in the courtroom, the claimant was jumped on by police who charged him with perjury for lying under oath. He had given evidence that he was Roger Tichborne. And as I'd said, it's, this was an assault on the ruling classes, the idea that any working man could come forward and claim to be one of them on the really pretty flimsy grounds. So, you know, it was pretty well understood that somebody with power was behind the ferocity of these police in prosecuting him so very quickly.
And so we go now from a civil trial to a criminal trial.
Criminal trial, that's exactly right.
And the whole process starts all over again.
The process did start again. Many more witnesses came forward, and both sides spent a lot of money in securing witnesses and procuring witnesses from all ends of the earth. And this was the stage at which, once he was out on bail, the claimant went out on the road and won a lot of support, financial support, as well as just the support of numbers from the working classes. He became a working class hero, particularly in the factory towns and cities of the north of England. He had a huge following and would deliver his story, which he became a real showman at doing, before audiences of thousands in the equivalent of, you know, football stadiums. So he would, obviously, everybody would pay to attend, but somebody also came up with the great idea of selling Tichborne bonds, which were a very direct means of getting people to invest. You'd pay, I think it was £1 for one of these bonds, which people could and did hang on their walls, which was, looked like a legal document, said that they would be entitled to a cut of the Tichborne fortune when he came into his rightful title and means.
The idea that people would hang it on their walls would suggest that not only is it about the money and the potential income that you'll get when this all pays off, but also the idea of you putting a flag in the ground and staking your own claim as to who you support and who you are as a person.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Yep. Yep. It really was flying a flag.
So what happened? What was the end result of this criminal trial?
Well, the criminal trial went on for more than a year. No, almost a year. And was just the biggest news of the day. It was covered. The newspapers in those times were solid pages of 8 columns of minuscule print. And the Times of London would dedicate not just one, but 2 solid pages of text every day to the Tichborne trial. Such was the following that it had. So this went on 4 months and months, and the outcome was that the claimant was found guilty of perjury, 2 counts of perjury, and the judge insisted that he would serve 2 terms, 14 years. The maximum term for perjury was 7, and instead of allowing him to serve concurrent terms, he insisted he would serve sequential terms of 14 years and no less in prison. So he was punished to the full extent of the law. And he went to prison and never ceased to insist that he was Sir Roger Tichborne. Likewise, his family, I think he had 3 or 4 children by this time, particularly his elder daughter, Agnes, who changed her name to Teresa, don't know why. She went performing too. Insisted that she was the rightful daughter of Sir Roger Tichborne.
And he began to lose weight in prison.
He did, yeah, as you would. Well, yeah, so he lost quite a lot of weight. He was never back to Roger's original dimensions, but he was a much more slender man. And photographs of him after he was released from prison, he was certainly a different man and more approximated what Roger might have become.
Did people turn around and say, "See, we told you," or now being some years later, people had gotten over it?
People had by and large gotten over it. I think he did a bit of performing, but to dwindling audiences. You know, he went around telling his story before audiences, but he didn't have the cachet and the following that he once had had. He was a bit of a sad character, lived a fairly circumscribed sort of life as a tobacconist who would entertain people with stories of what he might have been.
There's two different ways that story can go. One is that it is a nobleman who's been stripped of everything that is his birthright, and it is a great crime has been committed against this man, and it's a tragedy. And the other is that he is a con artist and a swindler who got exactly what he deserved, and that justice was done. Is there a third option?
The third option to me is that he believed the story. Now, you could still say that he got what he deserved because he was trying to get something that wasn't his, but he'd convinced himself. I mean, I called my book The Man Who Lost Himself because I really think that he ended up believing his own story.
I guess like all good con artist stories, they tell you more about the people and the society that you're in than they do about the con artists themselves.
They sure do.
I always finish the podcast with something called the Con Man's Dictionary, which I always spring on my guests, which is I give you a word, like a piece of terminology from the world of the con artist, and see if you can either correctly identify what it is or come up with a possible explanation. And then I edit out all the pauses.
So what do you got for me?
Okay, so it's the big store.
The big store.
The big store.
I cannot imagine what the big store would be. I'm thinking of it because I'm thinking of the Tichborne claimant. I'm thinking of Wagga Wagga. I'm thinking of something the claimant might have done that could have been called the big store. The big store. It has something to do with the refrigerator. I just have. Now this isn't the claimant. This is or maybe an icebox. No, I don't know.
People used to play these little street con games, like three card Monty and the
shell game. Yeah,
the shell game, which I'm a big fan of. But the problem was they lacked legitimacy. So the big store, the idea was that you would open a dollar store that would sell goods, and you would just happen to have people playing this game at the end of the counter. And by providing a legitimate surrounding for the game, people were more likely to get involved, because they'd say, well, the owners of this establishment wouldn't let people play a crooked game on their counter, not realizing that the entire store exists just for the purpose of playing
the game. It would be worth opening a big store for that purpose?
Just for this little game, yeah, because people would lose thousands and thousands of dollars.
I can't believe that.
So there's fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
That's great. Thanks, Nicholas.
Cheers. Thank you. As always, you can find out more at conman.com.au. This has been Scammapalooza.